Must have been caught on camera. I need you to look at the footage, Ella. He glanced over to where the boys were sitting quietly, looking at some books. He lowered his voice. Miles mustn't see it, Marie. Would you stay here with Chris and Don and watch the children? Marie nodded, and he and Ella left the room. Marie introduced herself to the brothers.
Oh, you're the Sarge.
Ryan looked at her with interest.
My uncle has told us about you.
Marie wondered what was going to come next. Nice things, I hope? Well, Miles looked at her critically. We're not sure if he's telling Porky's. Try me, and I'll tell you.
He says you ride a huge motorcycle.
True. Next question.
How huge?
Pretty big. You should get him to bring you to the police station one day and you can see for yourself. You could sit on it if you want. Miles's face clouded over.
Mummy says they're dangerous.
Oh, dear.
Mummy was right, they can be, but not if you ride them carefully and know what you're doing. I would never let any harm come to you. My bike's name is Harvey.
That's a silly name for a motorbike. Ryan sounded rather superior.
It's named after someone I know, and it reminds me of him.
She refrained from telling them exactly why, that Harvey Cash's thunderous farts had reminded her of someone kick-starting an old 650cc Triton.
Uncle said you were on Amazon. But we looked and looked and we couldn't find you.
Marie could cheerfully have throttled Jackman. How would she explain that one? Luckily, she was saved by a broadly grinning Chris Bourne.
No, kids, you got it wrong. Your uncle said the Sarge was an Amazon. There were warrior princesses in Greek mythology, tall and strong and fearless. Your uncle reckons that when Marie rides her bike, she's like an Amazon warrior queen.
Marie glowered at him. What rubbish. Shut up, Chris. But Miles was clearly impressed.
Wow.
Ryan just nodded sagely, evidently well-versed in the myths and legends of ancient Greece. Chris, who had three children of his own, steered the conversation to superheroes. Marie breathed a sigh of relief. Soon, a stony-faced Jackman appeared in the doorway and beckoned to her. Outside, he whispered.
Ella has pointed him out. He's there all right, and he obviously didn't give a toss about the cameras.
Any full face shots?
No. He knew exactly where they were and he kept his face turned away. All we can do is get the pictures enhanced and try to pick out anything that could identify him.
IT will be able to estimate his age, won't they, from the way he moves and his general physique?
It won't be very accurate, but yes. And it will all help to build up a picture. Shame there are no more cameras in the area. He'll have had a car somewhere nearby.
Are you okay? She asked quietly.
Jackman sighed.
Yes. I daren't read too much into this, although it's hard not to. It could have been anyone, not necessarily Miles's bad man. Ella is as uptight as hell with worry about the boys. She could have blown it out of proportion. She's a good-looking woman. Maybe what she saw was a guy who was interested in her.
Marie doubted that. Ella was sensible, and she certainly wouldn't have imagined or misconstrued that pointed gesture.
I know what you're thinking, Marie, but right now I have to have hard evidence before I go into panic mode.
Jackman took her arm and pulled her a little closer. I'm considering ditching the home protection and getting them into a safe house. What do you think? Am I overreacting?
She shook her head.
No way. I'd do it immediately, even if it's just until we get a better handle on this.
Then I'll notify the superintendent.
He pulled out his phone, which showed an incoming call.
Mum, is everything all right?
Marie saw Jackman's face darken.
Look, don't worry, he said. I have something to sort out here and then I'll be straight over.
He hung up and stared at Marie.
Something odd happened at Mother's stable. Some man came and asked her to stable his horse. He claims to be an old friend, but I've never heard of an Edward Craven. Marie felt a chill of apprehension. I'll go with you to your mother's. Is she worried about this man?
No, not at all. She just wanted to know if I'd vouch for him before she accepted his horse for livery.
She frowned. Could be a bona fide misunderstanding, I suppose. But we should check it out.
I must tell Ella what we're doing, said Jackman. She'll need to collect stuff for the boys, clothes, games, toiletries. I'll get Chris and Don to escort her home, then a protection officer will take it from there.
They heard Ella's voice behind them.
Do I get a say in this?
It's only for your safety. All of you, Jackman said softly. And it won't be for long.
You don't know that, Jackman. Actually, I think I'd rather stay at Raynham Lodge, as long as we have those police officers with us.
She looked at Jackman.
It would be almost impossible to keep two recently bereaved youngsters occupied and happy in a safe house. Don't you think they're confused enough? What would that do to them? They need stability. They certainly don't need to be bundled off to some hotel room for an indefinite period of time.
Marie nodded slowly.
She has a point, doesn't she? I don't think I'd looked further than the safety issue.
Jackman held up his hands.
All right. But do not go charging around town on your own, understood?
Promise. Once was enough, thanks.
Ella gave them a rueful smile.
I'll leave the detective stuff to you from now on.
Marie grinned at her.
Too right. But at least you've got us a description of him.
Ella grimaced. Fat lot of good it was, too. Thick, dark, wavy hair, tall, dark clothing, and a neat line in scary gestures.
Could be worse, said Marie.
At least we can rule out short, fat, blonde men and chubby redheads.
She looked at Jackman, but he seemed to be miles away.
Jackman, we should get over to your mother's stables.
Sorry. Oh, yes.
Ella,
are you absolutely certain about this?
Her look said it all.
Then let's fetch the boys and put Chris and Don in the picture and get you out of here.
Harriet rolled up a lunge rein and put it in a drawer in the tack room.
He seemed, well, so plausible. Then after I'd spoken to you, I thought the way he dashed off for an appointment before he gave me all his details was a bit suspicious.
She looked at Jackman, her face etched with concern.
Do you think he's the man who hurt Sarah?
He'd already rung the number the man had given her. It was unobtainable, but he didn't tell his mother that.
Mum, this could be nothing and we have no idea who he is. Tell me again what he looked like.
Harriet busied herself hanging up bridles and straightening out reins, as if keeping her hands occupied would make her think more clearly.
He was very well dressed, smart in that county manner. Moleskin trousers in a stone colour, a navy and cream check shirt and a well-worn barber. He had thick, wavy, dark brown hair and dark eyes. He looked like a rider and he seemed to know his horses. That's why I thought no more about him.
She looked apologetically from Jackman to Marie.
I'm so sorry. Knowing what is going on at the moment, I should have been on my guard, shouldn't I?
Jackman hugged his mother.
Oh, Mum, you weren't to know. Maybe he is kosher and I've just forgotten him. I meet a hell of a lot of people at functions.
He didn't really believe his own words, and suspected that the horse knowledge came from the University of Google. But his mother was looking uncharacteristically unsure of herself, and until he had proof, he needed to reassure her.
She finally extricated herself from his bear hug and said,
What on earth should I say if he does phone back?
Nothing. Because if the phone rings at 7, I'll answer it. That should tell us all we want to know, shouldn't it?
He looked at his watch.
Not long to wait now.
To pass the time, Harriet walked Marie around the stables and introduced her to some of her favourite horses.
Oh, I love this little guy,
Marie exclaimed, stroking the muzzle of a little grey pony. Harriet beamed.
That's Sherbet. I rescued him, and I'm getting him back to full health as a present for Ryan and Miles. He's gorgeous. The boys will be over the moon,
Marie sighed.
I've never ridden a horse, only motorcycles. Come down on your next day off and I'll show you what you're missing, Harriet offered. She'd love it, wouldn't she, Rowan? Do you know, I'm going to take you up on that. I'd love to. Marie grinned at him. Think I'll make a horsewoman?
Jackman smiled. If you ride a horse like you ride that bike, I'd say it's a given.
Excellent. That's a date.
Harriet looked more like her old self.
Rowan's right. I have a feeling you'll be a natural. You clearly have a fondness for them, and Sherbert loves you.
Jackman watched Marie tickle the pony's ears and checked his watch again.
Nearly time? Marie asked.
If he phones. At 7 o'clock precisely, the phone rang. Jackman, who is this, please?
For a moment there was silence.
Ah, an astute woman, your mother. But I'm pleased you answered.
Jackman let him speak.
You know who I am, Detective Inspector. Or should I say, you know who I was. The thing is, who am I now?
He gave a sharp laugh.
Alistair Ashcroft?
If you say so. But I rather think he doesn't exist anymore, Rowan.
No one calls me that,
snapped Jackman, unable to stop himself.
Except your mother. Oh, and your boss.
Jackman held his tongue. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see Marie talking urgently to someone on her own phone and knew she was trying to get a trace on the man's number.
I'm a very patient man, Jackman. With patience, there is nothing you can't find out.
What did he mean?
What do you want from me? Haven't you done enough already?
But, Detective, I want nothing from you other than your attention.
Well, you've got that. What now?
Don't patronize me.
It seemed to Jackman that all his training, all the years spent studying the psychology of the criminal mind, had been useless. He had absolutely no idea how to handle this man.
I'm sorry.
He tried to sound sincere and to keep the man on the phone for as long as possible. But you must understand, I know what you've done, and I'm scared for the people closest to me. I have to know what you want.
You're right to be scared. Just consider this.
Until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I'll be in touch, Jackman. Goodbye. Jackman closed his eyes. He knew those words. Taken from the Book of Amos, Martin Luther King Jr. used them in his I Have a Dream speech. Alistair Ashcroft was telling him that he hadn't yet finished his quest for vengeance. There would be more deaths. Marie was staring at him, shaking her head.
They tracked it. And it's a local call, but an unregistered SIM card.
What else did he expect? At least he knew now who they were looking for, even if, in his words, he no longer existed. Jackman had lost his fear. Chapter 24. Jackman had never been much interested in his father's frenetic business ventures. He left all that to his brother, James. Now Jackman wondered if he should have looked closer. His father had taken charge. 30 minutes after hearing that his wife had been eye to eye with a killer, a van containing 4 security guards arrived at Lawrence Jackman's home. When Jackman asked his father what was going on, he merely said,
"Trust me, Rowan, I know what I'm doing."
Then he gripped Jackman's shoulder in a most uncharacteristic gesture.
"I may not have said so, son. But I know you are a damn good police officer. Go and do what you are best at, my boy. We are safe here. I suggest you consider bringing James, Ella, and the boys here, too."
Speechless, Jackman nodded. From what he had seen of those granite-faced guards, it was a viable option. Tomorrow he would put it to Ella and James and see what they thought. At around 8 o'clock in the evening, Jackman and Marie were on their way back to the station when Jackman's mobile made them both jump.
"Jackman?"
"Orla Kraken here, Inspector.
Jackman almost asked, "Who?"
Auric never used that name.
Auric never phoned him. She always used Marie as a go-between. "I'm sorry, but I really need you to come to the lab immediately," Auric said. He had never heard her sound so serious.
"Marie and I are on our way. Can I ask what it's about?"
"I'd prefer to explain when you get here, if that's all right.
We'll be with you in 10.
He ended the call and turned to Marie.
"Auric,
I asked her to trace the little brother."
Marie accelerated, and they arrived at Auric's lab in precisely 10 minutes. Auric was alone, and Jackman felt a little of his old discomfort return. But this was urgent, so he pushed it aside. Auric asked them to take a seat.
"Two things. First, a little earlier, I had to sort out a problem with Laura Archer's laptop. When she collected it, she left this for you."
She handed him an envelope.
"She was going on to another appointment, and when I told her I was going to ask you to call here tonight, she asked me to pass it on. She said to say it was a simplified outline of her thoughts about a man who has that level of control over others."
"Oh, thank you, I appreciate it."
Jackman took the envelope from her.
"And the second thing?"
Auric turned those metallic eyes on him.
"Now we move to hard facts, which is probably more to your liking right now. The Ashcroft family. God help them. With his high-profile business, Charles, the father, was easy to trace."
She handed Jackman several printouts from old newspaper articles and interviews on Ashcroft's self-made building empire. He had dragged himself up from the gutter and was keen to tell anyone and everyone about his abusive background and how he rose above it. He admits openly that his father was a violent man and domestic violence was a regular occurrence in their home. Auric picked up another file. Working on the assumption that Charles had possibly inherited some of his father's traits, I searched old police files for the Nettleby area, covering the years after he married his wife Louisa, and I found these. She passed him the reports. Police were called on several occasions by neighbours to disturbances at Ash Grange. The police knew exactly what was happening, but as no allegations were made by the wife, no action was taken.
"So, it was an abusive bully," Jackman said.
"As his old neighbour told us," added Marie. "And I should think a very nasty one, considering the wife finally ran away and left the children. That takes some doing, leaving your kids."
"Now," Auric continued, "you know what finally happened to poor Lindsay, and you also know that her brother Alistair dropped off the radar at the same time. What you didn't know is that there were 3 Ashcroft children, not 2.
Jackman and Marie exchanged glances. Then Jackman said,
"3 kids?"
"Yes, a boy, 1 year younger than Alistair. But then nothing, no medical records for the child and no primary school registration. I assumed he must have died, but I didn't find a death certificate. The other 2 children were correctly registered with doctors and schools, so why not the 3rd? I was beginning to think that unless he was given away or stolen by the fairies, I'd reached a dead end."
She flashed them her strange smile. "But not for long.
His name suddenly resurfaced into the system at exactly the same time as Alistair's disappeared."
"What was this mysterious 3rd sibling called?" asked Marie.
"Richard Stephen Ashcroft. Stephen spelt with an A."
"And in what way did he reappear?" Jackman asked.
"Charles Ashcroft enrolled him into a special school, privately run and expensive."
"But surely he enrolled Alistair?"
"Nope. He enrolled Richard."
"What the—"
Jackman puffed his cheeks out and exhaled.
Auric sat back. "I've had a little more time to think about this than you, D.I. Jackman, so please allow me to put forward my hypothesis. And it's the only thing that makes sense considering the facts I have here." She paused, then said, "If Richard died young, as I suspect he did, and for some reason his death wasn't registered, I'm guessing that Charles Ashcroft took Alistair to that school and enrolled him under his dead brother's name."
"How on earth would he get away with that?" Marie asked.
"If he had money, and we know he did, Richard's birth certificate and some kind of credible history, what was there to question?"
"It's possible,"
Jackman murmured. And it would fit in with what we've heard about Alistair being sent away to some kind of boarding school. You'll need to do some work on that, though, as the school closed down quite a few years ago, and I haven't had time to chase it up further, Orak added.
I guess if they were only a year apart, then the difference in age wouldn't be noticed, Marie said. And his old neighbour kept calling him a funny little thing. Maybe he was small for his age.
Quite possibly, Orak frowned.
I'm certain this is what happened, but I have no idea why the father would want to do such a thing.
And if the child died, why was his death never reported?
Jackman stared at Orak.
You're sure that neither parent reported an infant's death?
There is no record of it anywhere, but what I have found is that his wife's maiden name was Tasker. She placed a telephone number in front of him, and I've traced her mother. She lives near Malden in Essex. That's Liz Tasker's phone number. If she'll talk, you could have the answer to a lot of questions. I was dying to phone her myself, but I think that is something you must do.
She smiled at him and pointed to the end of her desk. There's the phone. Please be my guest.
Jackman talked to the woman for about 10 minutes, then replaced the receiver and exhaled loudly. That was one angry lady. She's given me the background, but we have a problem. The daughter suffered a severe mental breakdown and is now in a psychiatric unit. There is no easy way she can be questioned about her life with Charles Ashcroft.
Okay, but what did the mother tell you?
Marie asked impatiently.
Your assumption was correct, Orak. Apparently Charles knocked his wife senseless when she wanted to register the death. He swore it wasn't even his baby in the first place, even though it undoubtedly was. Her mother swears her daughter was too terrified of him to go with anyone else. In the end, Louisa stopped fighting him and allowed him to have his way. She never tried to register the death.
Jackman gritted his teeth.
Liz Tasker says if we excavate the garden at Ash Grange, we will find a baby's remains.
My God, Marie exclaimed. But why? Why hide the death? Did it have something to do with Charles?
No. Apparently the baby died after a seizure of some kind, and Mrs. Tasker says the reason the death was never reported was control, plain and simple. Complete control over Louisa, and the denigration of her personal wishes. Her child was never even given a proper funeral, so the poor woman had no closure. Charles was an abusive bully of the First Order, and finally things got so bad for Louisa that she ran away, leaving him and her two other children.
Left them? With a bully like that?
Marie shook her head.
In fairness, she told her mother his anger was only ever directed at her, not the kids.
He shrugged.
We now know that wasn't the case later on, but maybe she was right at the time, or maybe she just never saw it. What we do know is that by that time, Louisa was psychologically damaged, and she never made it to a better life halfway around the world. She finished up in a psychiatric unit, heavily medicated.
Jackman turned back to Orak.
This is a real step forward. Incredible stuff, Orak. Thank you.
Orak inclined her head.
All in a day's work, albeit a pretty long one. Don't forget Laura's notes. I won't. And thank you again.
For once, Jackman didn't feel like fleeing Orak's presence. He saw her better now, a valued and extremely talented colleague.
I really do appreciate your help.
Anytime. I'm always here. Now you know where to find me.
Orak gave Marie a sly, metallic wink and turned back to her screens.
Back in the CID room, DCI Cameron Walker was still beavering away at a computer.
What's this, Cam? Doing night duty?
I could ask the same of you two, he grinned. Kay is away at a seminar in Cambridge, so I thought I'd dig deeper into some of the Simmons family camp followers.
And we now know that Lindsay Ashcroft's little brother Alistair is our killer, Marie announced.
Cameron gaped at them.
How on earth did you find that out?
Oh, he rang Jackman and told him.
Jackman grinned. She's not joking either.
Cameron sat back in his chair.
I think this needs some explanation, don't you?
Let's go into my office and we'll fill you in.
I'll just put the name Richard Stephen Ashcroft into the PNC, then go and grab some strong coffees,
Marie said. Cam looks as if he could do with one.
3 sugars, please, Marie, for shock, but don't tell Kay if you see her.
As if.
Jackman sat in silence for a while, putting the sequence of events in order. Finally, he related the whole story, from Ella Jarvis spying on the man who had been watching the children, to his mother's visitor, and then the killer's chilling phone call. Marie added,
"And Orak has confirmed that Charles Ashcroft did place his son in a special school, but under his dead brother's name. Right now we can only surmise that little Alistair told his father something about Lindsay's death that he didn't want anyone else to hear, so he got him out of the way, fast.
So we were right to think that Alistair might have witnessed something that night and it never came out at the trial?" Cam asked.
Jackman nodded. "Looks that way. And whatever it was, it seems to have sent her little brother on a vengeful killing spree."
Cameron sipped his coffee.
"I'm still not sure how Charles Ashcroft got away with switching his son's identities. Surely he would have needed medical reports to get the boy into the school."
"It would seem that young Alistair was never assessed. In fact, although he was registered with a local GP, he was only ever seen for a few inoculations. His school reports mention only that he was a very quiet child and not a good mixer."
Marie shrugged.
"I think Charles flashed a lot of cash, turned on the charm and the crocodile tears, and spun a yarn about the family trying to manage the boy's behavioral problems until they realized he needed specialist help that they were prepared to pay for."
"And an assessment will have been done then, in the name of Richard."
Jackman scribbled some notes on a memo pad.
"First thing tomorrow, we need to find out more about that school and talk to someone."
Cam nodded. Then he frowned.
"Okay, so Dad bundles the problem child into a private school. But surely the boy wouldn't have answered to Richard when his name was Alistair. And why didn't he simply tell the truth about himself?"
"Fear," chorused Jackman and Marie. "His father was a violent bully. We know that from 2 sources already. And we've not even started asking proper questions yet. The child was most likely threatened, and witnessing his sister's murder must have traumatized him. He would have been pleased to get away and hide."
Jackman shook his head.
"We can only guess what those 2 kids suffered after the mother ran off."
"Ah, I see."
Cam folded his arms and exhaled.
"After his sister's murder, his mental condition must have been one of total shock. He could even have had some sort of dissociative amnesia," Jackman added.
Cam nodded.
"Maybe that's what sent him on his terrible journey of revenge."
Jackman leaned back in his chair and stretched his arms above his head.
"What a bloody awful day. I'm exhausted."
Marie smiled at him. "I'm not surprised after what you've had to cope with in the last 24 hours. She finished her drink. "Still, we are so much further forward than we were."
"Yes and no."
Jackman ached all over.
"We know who the killer is, but we have no clue as to what bogus identity he's now hiding behind. How's that for a conundrum?"
Cam stood up.
"Whatever, my friend, it's a puzzle for tomorrow. You need some rest."
"I'm not arguing, Cam, believe me," Jackman sighed. "However, there is one thing I can't ignore." He waved the notes that Laura had sent them. "We need to read this."
Marie took it from him, saying,
"Photocopier. A copy each. Take it home, read it before we come in tomorrow, and then we can discuss it. Cam is right. It's something for tomorrow, not tonight, and that, sir, is an order."
Marie sat up in bed, and for a second time went through Laura's notes. They had dealt with some terrible people in their time, but this man had to be the worst. She pulled the duvet up around her and slid down into its warmth. She couldn't begin to imagine the workings of his brain, but what really scared her was his utter self-possession. The school's CCTV footage showed the casual way he skipped between the parked cars, twisting aside to avoid the cameras. It was almost a dance. He was enjoying himself.
Laura described the killer as devious, deceptive, exploitative, a master of manipulation. His power resided in his knowledge of his victims' vulnerabilities and his ability to make use of them. He was totally ruthless, caring nothing for his victims. It is probable that he led Sarah and Suri to believe they were guilty of complicity in a terrible miscarriage of justice. He then escalated his accusations until the women were so confused that they doubted their recollections of what really happened. And when they were ready, he used threats to their children's lives to push them into total submission, and finally, death. Marie wondered how this poor little thing, as Beatrice had called him, had turned into such an intelligent, calculating avenger. It seemed that Laura had brought Sam in on it, and the two psychologists had discussed multiple kinds of complex personality disorders, but she had simplified it to say they believed that the killer exhibited traits of what was known as the Dark Triad. A trio of psychoses. Anyone who exhibited all three of these traits would have a very malevolent nature, and would be a danger to the mental health of those around them. These people were usually extremely intelligent and highly functioning, but their self-image was unstable and illusory. They concluded that the killer was an extraordinarily evolved version of this particular disorder. Marie put down the paper and turned out the light. She hoped that Jackman was asleep and not poring over Laura's notes as she had been. He had looked drained, but she knew him very well. He wouldn't give up until he found the killer. Chapter 25. Jackman started awake at around 5 a.m. Laura's notes lay unopened beside his bed, where he had dropped them the night before. He had intended to read them before going to sleep, but had succumbed to exhaustion and fallen into a deep slumber. He stretched. While the sleep seemed to have done the trick, his old fervor burned like a torch in the cold darkness. He picked up the pages and began to read. Laura referred to studies that found that people with a controlling megalomania such as their killer exhibited often believed that they were far more omniscient and powerful than they really were. This could be a way to bring him down. She had added, "Try to see things as they are, Jackman, not how he wants you to see them. He's not all-powerful. No human being is. Remember what happened to Machiavelli. He was tortured, imprisoned, alienated from the society he had devoted his life to, and he died a bitter man." Jackman wondered if that were really true. He liked to think that evil people paid dearly for their transgressions, but he knew that wasn't always the case. At university, he and his fellow students sometimes debated whether Stalin or Hitler had been the world's worst mass murderer. Jackman had voted for Stalin. That man had overseen the deaths of millions of his own people, and instead of being brought to justice, he died of a heart attack while still in power. Jackman shook off these negative thoughts. He had to catch this man. He would catch him. The morning passed in a frenetic blur. The CID office was alive with the sound of phones, printers, voices, and the feet of staff coming and going. Jackman spent the whole morning in his office, fielding questions, delegating tasks, and overseeing progress. At around 12, Cameron knocked on his door. "We found the special school." Jackman almost punched the air. It was a massive step forward.
"Where?"
"It's just outside Spalding. The name has changed from the one Orak tracked, and it no longer functions as it did back then. It's now part of a group of schools that specialize in children with learning difficulties. The good thing is, I've tracked down the name of the head that was in charge in the 90s, and he lives here in Sultan the Fen. I've phoned him and he's in all day. Would you like to go and see him, or shall I?"
"You go, Cam, and take Marie with you."
He glanced at his desk and the mountain of paperwork, on top of which was a memo written in thick black felt pen. "Ruth Crook, meeting, 12:30. I'm a bit tied up until after lunch." Cameron nodded.
"We'll go right away."
Cameron opened the door to Robbie Melton.
"Sir, I've been to see one of the men who support Sheila Simmons' cause, Jeremy Shaw.
Jackman had to think for a moment. Ah, sure, a well-known radical, but a loner, according to the sources. And? He's certainly motivated. There are giant posters of Che Guevara on his walls, and he probably has every newspaper article ever printed about the trial of Brendan Simmons. Seems to attach himself to lost causes. He lectured me for several minutes before he realized I was a copper, and he got really bolshy.
Description?
As far as looks go, he fits the bill. He's dark, tall, and around 40, I guess.
Robbie looked at Jackman.
But the only vibes I picked up were a particular dislike of the police. Plus, he loves the sound of his own voice, so nothing significant.
Can we take him off the list, do you think?
Robbie frowned. Unless he's a consummate actor, he doesn't seem to fit the profile for Alistair Ashcroft.
So who have you got next?
Robbie glanced at his notebook. Well, we were hoping to tackle either Dale or Liam Simmons, but we can't pin them down, so Max and I are just off to see Art Pullen. Reliable Art, according to your notes.
Jackman remembered Kenny saying how Art always turned out for a meeting, a protest, a march, anything and everything.
Okay. But if you think he's simply another enthusiastic camp follower, don't spend too much time on him, will you?
No, boss. We'll give him the once-over and report back.
When Robbie had gone, Jackman looked at the memo again. He was pretty certain he was on borrowed time. His close family were involved now, so it wouldn't be long before Ruth was obliged to ask him to hand the investigation to someone else. He couldn't let that happen. He couldn't. From the moment he'd heard Alistair's voice on his mother's phone, the case had become truly personal. He drew in a long breath. This investigation had started with Sarah Jackman. Rowan Jackman would finish it. It felt odd to be out with a different senior officer, but Marie had liked Cameron from the very beginning. For a DCI, he really was a breath of fresh air. They found the old headmaster in a flat in a very nice retirement village on the outskirts of town. After the introductions, Ralph Burgess invited them in and disappeared into the small galley kitchen to make tea. Marie looked around the room. As old people's residences went, this was the best she'd seen. It had a lounge and a separate bedroom, along with a shower room and the narrow kitchen, but it didn't feel cramped or claustrophobic. Ralph had kept several good pieces of furniture, including an oak bookcase that groaned with books. A panorama of school photographs covered one wall from floor to ceiling. Marie's hopes rose. When tea had been poured, Ralph asked,
"Was it Richard Ashcroft that you wanted to know about?"
"Yes, sir," said Cameron. "Only we have recently discovered that he was enrolled with you under a false name, that of his dead brother. His real name was Alistair Ashcroft."
Ralph Burgess digested this information. Then he nodded slowly.
"That could explain a lot of questions we had about that boy."
"You remember him clearly, sir?" asked Marie. The man gave a tight little laugh.
"Oh, yes. There are some children you never forget."
He stood up and went to his photo display. After searching for a moment, he removed two framed photographs and returned to his chair. From a side table, he took a handsome magnifying glass with a carved handle and examined the pictures.
"Here he is. The year he came to us."
He handed the picture to Cameron.
"Second row from the front, in the center."
He then showed them the second photograph.
"And this was the year he left. Rather a change, isn't there?"
Marie looked at the pictures. The child in the first image was small, hunched, with feral eyes. But in the second picture, he was standing in the back row, a head above his classmates, tall, strong, and with a clear, intelligent gaze.
"That's the same boy?" asked Cam incredulously.
"Hard to believe, isn't it? Mind you, we had a whole year of hell with him, and then something just clicked. He started to thrive and never look back."
Ralph looked proud of the transformation.
"He was a real success story."
"Tell us about his first year, especially when he first arrived. Did you meet the father?
Cameron had his notebook and pen ready.
Ralph frowned.
I did, and I saw through him immediately. Oh, he said all the right things, declared that his wife was on the verge of a breakdown over the child, how he'd done all that was humanly possible to keep Richard at home. But after his sister's demise, things had become intolerable, etc., etc.
Marie smiled wryly.
But you still took him?
I decided, after a very short conversation, that it was in the child's best interests to get him away from his home. I didn't know exactly what was going on, but the father wanted full board, so, yes, we took him in.
His face darkened.
I never saw the father again. His fees were paid through a solicitor, and the payments continued after the father died in a car crash.
And prior to his death, he never visited his son? Cameron asked.
Never. It was as if he was glad to be shot of the boy.
Nice man, muttered Marie. So what was the boy like?
For a long time, he never spoke at all. He seemed unable to interact with others and suffered from extreme anxiety. Because we'd been given no medical history, we really struggled.
He picked up his mug of tea and drank thoughtfully.
We ruled out autism, Asperger's syndrome, and a dozen different learning difficulties. One of our very experienced staff has certainly suffered from Fragile X syndrome, and for a time I agreed.
Cameron tilted his head.
Fragile X? I've never heard of that.
Not well known, I agree, Ralph said, but it's actually the most common cause of learning disabilities. It's a genetic condition that is found more often in boys than girls, and girls often have milder disabilities. The thing was, there are often physical features associated with Fragile X. A long, narrow face with prominent jaw and ears, and Richard did seem to have those.
Marie recalled Miles's drawing of the bad man. That pointed chin and dark almond-shaped eyes. She had never been able to fathom who or what it reminded her of.
It took a long while to understand that it wasn't a genetic disorder at all. Richard was simply a damaged child. Emotional and physical abuse had made him what he was.
Ralph's face brightened.
But when we understood that, we had something to work on, and my staff and I began to find ways to bring him out of himself.
He laughed softly.
The best thing we ever did was to take him to our school playhouse. Richard suddenly began to talk, but only when he was acting a role. As Richard Ashcroft, he seemed incapable of thought or action.
How long did he remain with you, sir?
Cameron asked.
Until he was 17.
And where did he go from there? Marie wondered.
Ralph shook his head.
We never heard from him again.
Did he give any indication what career he wanted to take up? I suppose he was employable by that time, Cameron asked.
Oh, Richard was highly intelligent. His IQ was around 140, as I recall, around genius level.
What is normal? Marie inquired, recalling Charlie Button's words. There's a fine line between idiocy and genius.
Between 90 and 110.
Marie's heart sank. So not only were they chasing a megalomaniac psychopath, but he was a bloody genius to boot. Ralph raised a finger.
But that can sometimes come at a price. Mental illness and very high intelligence are sometimes linked, and when you consider the boy's background, I would be very surprised if he made it to maturity without suffering a serious psychiatric condition at some stage.
You don't know how right you are. Marie added silently.
In answer to your question regarding a career, Richard could have done anything he wanted, and whatever that was, he would excel at it.
Ralph nodded, as if to himself. Marie glanced to Cameron.
We're sorry to take up more of your time, sir, but I was wondering if there was any way you could find the name of the Ashcroft family solicitor for us.
That's easy. Ashcroft Senior used the same solicitor as I do, and they're still operating from their head office in Greenborough. I'll give you their number.
Ralph went to the bookcase and took down an old, well-used address book.
"Bell and Murchison, 14 Old Cask Yard, Greenborough."
He gave them the phone number, then stopped and looked at them.
"Is he in trouble, officers?"
Marie nodded. "He could be, sir. Serious trouble." Ralph looked deeply saddened.
"And I had such high hopes for him. I honestly believed that one day I'd read about him in the papers, work that he'd done, or that he'd achieved something truly amazing."
He sighed. Marie felt very sad. Ralph Burgess had spent years putting a broken boy back together again, and when the truth came out, he would know it had all been for nothing. There was indeed a very good chance that his pupil would make the papers, though not in the way his old mentor would have liked. Chapter 26. At precisely 12:30, Jackman knocked on the door of the superintendent's office.
"Ah, good, Rowan. Come in and sit down," Ruth said.
His heart sank. She was being nice. Never a good sign. Ruth looked at him in silence for a while, and then shook her head.
"I know what you're expecting. Well, you've been given a stay of execution. As the details of this investigation haven't yet been made public, the Deputy Chief Constable has instructed me to allow you to carry on for the time being, so long as you show no sign of undue emotional stress. You'll check in regularly with the FMO and Laura Archer, and they will in turn report their findings directly to me. Are we clear?"
Jackman nodded mutely, trying to understand why on earth the DCC had interceded on his behalf.
"And having got that over with, thank you for keeping me up to speed on what's going on."
She rested her chin on a cupped hand. "Discovering that Alistair Ashcroft is behind it all is quite remarkable progress." Jackman dared a smile.
"The team with DCI Cameron Walker's help have been working flat out, ma'am.
And it hasn't gone unnoticed. Tell me, do you really believe this man is now directly targeting you and your family? Only I have a theory, from a complete outsider's point of view, of course."
Jackman chose his words carefully.
"He has put the frighteners on us, certainly. And from his threat to my sister-in-law, Sarah, his use of the phrase, dashing your little ones against the rocks, my biggest fear is that he will carry out this threat, even if Sarah herself is dead."
Ruth Crook inclined her head slightly.
"That's a reasonable fear to have, Rowan, but I don't think he will do that."
Jackman leaned forward.
"Why, Ruth?"
"I'm not sure, but I think he is after your undivided attention. I think he wants, no, needs you to know who he is and what he's capable of. I think you are his chosen dueling opponent, a Sherlock to his Moriarty, if you will."
"Why? Why me? I know some serial killers crave attention, but usually it's to get their names in the media. They want fame."
Ruth raised her hands.
"It's just a theory. Let's gather everything we can on Alistair, and we'll look into his profile together with Laura, and maybe Professor Sam Page as well. She tells me he's assisting with your nephews?"
Jackman nodded. "Sam's a good man. We could certainly use his input."
"Okay. Well, every man and woman available is ready and willing to help you. I suggest you get back out there and find Ashcroft."
Jackman returned to the CID room, still wondering why the DCC should have intervened. Moreover, why had he taken his side? After all, the most natural reaction would have been to take him off the case. He gave a relieved sigh. What mattered most was that he was still in the game. At 1 o'clock, the man who had once been Alistair Ashcroft made ready to go to work. His father, a successful businessman and asshole, had amassed a fortune, and when he obligingly did away with himself, Alistair's future was assured. He was the only heir, and there was money aplenty. He didn't have to work at all, but it was part of his new persona. He looked around his home to check that everything was in order. Attention to detail was vital. He would never have succeeded so well had he not been meticulous in everything he did. He took his jacket from the hall cupboard. He would leave his motorbike and walk to work today, perhaps calling in at the church on the way. He had the beginnings of a new idea, and the quiet would help him formulate a plan. He locked the door and strolled beneath the bare-limbed trees. By now, Jackman would be interviewing everyone involved in the murder trial. He supposed that the Simmons family and their supporters would be first in line. Well, it would keep his detective busy, though it would soon be time for them to meet. The church tower rose before him. He would calculate his next move, and then he'd set the stage for their confrontation. It was time Jackman realized just who he was up against. Harriet sounded like her old self again.
"Son, I've been wondering if you've given any more thought to your father's idea of bringing Ella, James, and the boys to stay with us."
"I haven't had a minute to spare, Mum. I was going to speak to Ella first."
"I've spoken to her, Rowan, and she thinks it would do the boys good. They can't go to school, and they'll soon be bored. There's plenty here to keep them entertained, and they'd be watched over like royalty."
Jackman thought of those security guards.
"Okay, that's fine with me if they want to. What does James think?"
There was a short silence.
"He's busy working, Rowan. He told Ella he'd agree to whatever she wanted to do."
"Hell, Mom, couldn't he just for once..."
She spread her hands.
I know. But it's the only way he can cope at the moment. Give him some time, please."
He bit back his retort.
"I'll tell the superintendent and arrange transport for Ella and the boys. As long as you're sure."
"We are, son. We'd feel much happier if we were all together."
Sitting ducks. Jackman wasn't convinced.
"Okay, Mom, I'll ring Ella and ask her to get ready."
"Before you go, Rowan, don't be angry with him, but your father had a quiet word with a golfing friend of his."
She looked at him rather sheepishly.
"Who I believe might just have been a deputy chief constable."
"Mom, I don't need father's help to hold on to my job."
"He meant it for the best, Rowan, and did it because he believes that you, of all people, can get to the bottom of all this. He did it because he trusts you, and he didn't want this conflict of interest thing holding you back. So, as I said, don't be cross, dear."
Jackman gritted his teeth, then suddenly felt quite emotional. To hear that his father trusted him and thought he was the best man for the job was extraordinary.
"Don't worry, Mom. It's fine."
Ella had already begun to pack when he rang.
"Your parents are right, Jackman, and it's also one less worry for you. Your mom says the security men are highly trained ex-military men, used to protecting VIPs and government ministers. I reckon we'll be safer there than anywhere, don't you?"
Keeping his reservations to himself, Jackman agreed.
"I've seen those goons. Mom's right about them. But even so, keep your wits about you, won't you, Ella? I've just learned that the man we're up against has an extremely high IQ."
Ella laughed.
"Good. It's been my experience that highly intelligent people have little or no common sense."
Jackman chuckled.
"Nevertheless, I'm not going to underestimate this man."
"Nor are we."
Her tone was serious now.
"I'm not letting those two lads out of my sight for 1 minute, police protection or not."
"Thank you, Ella. And I mean that. It means such a lot to me. And to Mom, too, knowing that you are looking out for them."
"I'm glad I can help. I wish the circumstances had been different, that's all. They are lovely children."
Ella paused.
"They're Sarah's children. And I think she was a lovely person, too. More than anyone, I'm doing it for her."
"Hang on in there, Ella. We have half the Fenland Constabulary working on catching him."
"Maybe you could use the other half, too. I could do with a night's sleep."
"You and me both."
Jackman entered the call. How easy Ella was to talk to. It was just such a shame that she had chosen to leave a job she was so good at. Still, if she hadn't left, where would they be now? Jackman wondered what Ella would do when all this was over, and Ryan and Miles no longer needed her. Jackman worried that she might grow too attached to his nephews, and then her cycle of depression could begin all over again. He straightened up and took hold of his wandering thoughts. It was ridiculously early to be thinking about what might happen years down the line. What was he doing wool gathering like this? He should be working. It was a relief to see Marie. "I've spoken to the firm of solicitors that dealt with the Ashcroft estate. They assured me that they did deal with Charles's will and that his son Richard inherited the whole estate." Marie sat down, facing Jackman. "That part is fine. It backs up what Ralph Burgess told us. The next bit, however..."
Marie sighed. "It's not so good," Jackman said.
"It's crap, actually." Marie pulled a face. "As soon as he was of age, as they say, Richard took every penny out of the investments and banks, sold the properties, of which there were three, and did a disappearing act. It's anyone's guess where the money went."
"Would that anyone include Orak?" Jackman said. "I'm sure I heard you say that one of her specialities was tracing money."
Marie smiled. "Of course. I'll go and see her."
"How are the others doing? Anything interesting come out of the interviews yet?" Jackman asked.
"Not a thing. In fact, none of the interviewing teams have had the slightest suspicion about any of them. The two big problems are Liam and Dale Simmons. No matter how hard we try, we never catch them in."
Jackman shrugged. "It won't be Dale, anyhow. We've seen him, remember? He's tall and fairly dark-haired, but you saw him. He's big. Bit of a tank, really. And the man in the school CCTV footage was slim. Dale doesn't fit at all."
"I agree. But why is he avoiding us?"
"To piss us off. He hates us, Marie." Marie stood up.
"Oh, well, there are a few more people to talk to, then we'll have to look further afield, I guess."
"What's Cam doing at the moment?"
asked Jackman. "He and his DC Penny are trawling through the PNC and local intelligence to look for any mentions of a Richard Stephen Ashcroft. We're pretty sure he won't be known to us for any criminal offences, but Cam wants to see if the name pops up in relation to some other matter."
"I don't think they'll find him, but we have to check."
Jackman was certain they wouldn't find Ashcroft. He was far too smart.
"Go talk to Orak. She's our best bet."
He grinned.
"And send her my regards."
Marie laughed. "Oh, I will, don't worry." James Jackman finished the conference call with his counterparts across the country and heaved a sigh of relief. Another lucrative deal pulled off. He pushed back his chair and stood up. He went over to the window and stared out. Every time his mind was freed from work, the terrible pain flooded in and threatened to drown him. James knew how his continuing to work looked to others, but it was the only thing holding him together. Swallowing back a sob, James pulled out his smartphone and rang his brother.
"Rowan?" He fought to control the tears. "If you have a minute."
"James, of course. What's the matter?"
"I need to explain. I need to tell you why I'm here, and not with my children."
For several minutes he poured his heart out to his brother, told him of the dread of having too much thinking time, and his horrible fear of losing control of everything. Then it was Rowan's turn, and James found his brother's voice incredibly calming. He said he understood, but that somehow he had to find time to make Miles and Ryan understand too, because right now they didn't, and he could see them starting to think that their father was not there because of something they'd done. "Find some downtime with them, James. They love you, and you're all they have now." They talked for a while longer, and James came off the phone believing that he had said enough to make his brother really understand. The outpouring had done him good. It also made him realize how little time he and Rowan spent together. He wondered if they'd ever talked this openly before. He walked back to his desk and sat down. A new resolve coursed through him. He picked up the phone and asked for his secretary to come in.
"Sonia, no more calls, and I'll be leaving early."
He stopped, then added, "And any emergencies, refer them to one of the team, okay? I want to be with my boys."
Following yet another inconclusive interview, they were just about to return to the station when Max asked Robbie if they could call into Rosie's house, just to check on her. Robbie was fine with it, and in a few minutes they were pulling up outside a neat terraced house in Kiln Lane. "You're going, Max. I'll wait in the car. Give him my best, won't you?" As his colleague disappeared into the house, Robbie settled back and tried to decide if any of the people they had spoken to could have been a convincing liar. He was sure that they hadn't yet come face to face with the killer. So who could he be? From several sources, including the CCTV footage and a photo of Richard, given by his headmaster, IT had produced a passable likeness. No one they had interviewed looked even remotely like it. Robbie shifted in his seat. He, Jackman, and Marie had all agreed that there was something about that image, coupled with Jackman's nephew's drawing of the bad man, that rang a bell. Robbie's thoughts drifted to Marie again. He pushed them away. And yet he decided to speak to Max about cheering up his flat. If anyone could make it work, trendy Max Cohen would. 10 minutes later, Max heaved himself into the vehicle. His face was drawn. "Shit. Oh, what am I going to do? Is she no better, mate?" "No way. Worse, if anything. I'm worried sick about her, Rob." Max gave a long sigh. "I should take some time off. Be with her. But then take it, man. Jackman will understand. We're all really concerned about her, including him." Max looked at him. "What? With a maniac on our bleeding doorstep? I can't let the team down." "But aren't you letting Rosie down? Who's most important?" "That's not fair," Max said. "It is. You told me you love that girl. I think she needs you right now, don't you?" Max was silent for a while. "You're right, Robbo. Priorities and all that. I'll talk to the boss as soon as we get back." They were about half a mile from the station when the call came in. Max put the phone on loudspeaker for Robbie to hear.
"DC Cohen, would you and DC Melton proceed immediately to number 4, Bell Chime Buildings, Belmont Road? PC Stoner is in attendance. We have a report of a suspicious death."
Robbie swung the car around.
"Reckon it's another one."
"We'll soon know, won't we, mate?"
Max sounded about as miserable as it was possible to be. Poor sod, thought Robbie. This could well put paid to his request for leave.
"Let's pray it's just a natural sudden death. It could be nothing to do with our bad man."
Neither of them believed that for a minute.
"Can we come over and talk to you, Jackman?"
Laura sounded slightly on edge. "We?" Jackman asked.
"Sam's with me. We've been reviewing what we know about your bad man."
"Then come now. We've just had a heads up about another death. Robbie and Max are on their way to evaluate the scene, and if it's our killer, I might have to go out quite soon."
Jackman was still trying to get over his brother's tearful phone call. It had made him appreciate the mental turmoil that James was in. His mother had been right. He needed to give James time. And now this. Another death. Seated with Laura in his office, Sam sounded more serious than usual.
"This will probably sound strange, Jackman, but we have an idea about how your man operates.